We are undergoing a mass extinction event globally. We're losing species at a rapid rate due to human activities. So that's my big concern, is what can we do to reverse that trend? And what I'm really focused on, wildlife policy and the way wildlife decisions are made, and, you know, mostly at the state level. And if you ask me, what can the listeners do? I will reply, there's some personal things, you know, like lifestyle things, but they really need to, we need certain changes at the policy level in New Mexico to address the challenges.
Southwest Environmental Center Executive Director Kevin Bixby and PBS New Mexico Environment Reporter Laura Pascas. Join us next for the Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public. 575-646-2212 to join the conversation next on KRWG Public Media. 106 at KRWG. Good afternoon. This is Casey Counts. Glad to be with you on the Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public. And today we're joined by PBS New Mexico Environment Reporter Laura Pascas. Good afternoon, Laura. Thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
And we are also joined by Southwest Environmental Center Executive Director Kevin Bixby. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We'll get to some of the things you touched on in the introduction to our show, of course, through the course of this hour. But first, Kevin, tell us a little bit about your background and your role at the Southwest Environmental Center.
Well, I'm a lifelong wildlife advocate. I started the Southwest Environmental Center just about 30 years ago, and I love my work. I feel like it's very rewarding, and it's very much needed, in my opinion. So I'm the executive director there.
Why did you develop such an interest in wildlife?
I've always had a love for wildlife and animals. I just had a connection. And I love wild nature too. So I don't know. It was a path chosen for me. I can't really point to one moment that set me on that path.
And Laura, how about you? How did you find yourself as an environment reporter for PBS New Mexico?
Oh, hi. So my first career in New Mexico was doing archaeology and tribal consultation, and I super loved field work and being outside and learning about landscapes and cultures. And migrated into the field of journalism about 20 years ago. And I endlessly fascinated by New Mexico and all the amazing and interesting things about our state.
Well, we didn't have to wait long for our first caller. We have Barbara on the line. The telephone number, if you have a question or something to add along the way today, 575-646-2212. Good afternoon, Barbara. Thank you for calling Voice of the Public. How are you?
I'm well, and how are you?
Great, thank you. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wanting to get Kevin's and Laura's thoughts about how to go about seeking out and establishing a better environmental ethic generally in one's local community in New Mexico and in USA generally. Many years ago, in the 1970s, a good friend of mine and I took a long bicycle trip by train up to Seattle. Then we crossed over and we bicycled all up Vancouver Island, crossed over again to Vancouver, bicycled all around Vancouver, and bicycled all the way back down to Sacramento, California. And during that trip, we stopped at many cafes and local places in Canada where people were not defensive about speaking about such matters. They were friendly. The food was wonderful. And there were no guns, the threats of guns and all this kind of violence. And I just felt like it was, I don't know too much about the current state of environmentalism in Canada. I haven't really followed that over the years, but I found that trip refreshing because it was so easy to talk to people and welcoming, and it wasn't fraught with all of this violence and, wow, and contentiousness. And I was just wondering what your thoughts might be about how to establish a better environmental consciousness and community where we live.
Laura, would you like to go first?
Sure. So thanks for calling in. That's a great question. I think one of the things that I've seen just from covering these issues over the years is that community-based local groups that are coalesced around a love of place, a desire to protect their landscapes or communities, a willingness to listen to other members of their communities, kind of that like real basic nuts and bolts, like sitting down in a post-COVID world, if we have that, sitting down together, sharing meals, talking about ideas, thinking about the future together. I think that's where I kind of see the most long-term success on many, many projects are these really local community-driven efforts. And I'm sure Kevin has a lot to say about that.
It is a great question. And this is something I've thought about and not really come to any great definitive answers over my career. But I say there's two things, I think. One is we don't do a good job of teaching about how the natural world works. We don't emphasize ecology enough in our educational system. And so as a result, people by and large don't know how the natural world works and how important it is for us. As humans, we're not apart from that, even though it seems like we can live our lives and not be impacted by what happens in nature. But the reality is we are impacted. And the other thing I would say is it's not, at some point, the idea that humans are superior to the other 8 million species on the planet, that this planet was ours alone to use and for our purposes, we have to get beyond that. Some people call that speciesism, that, you know, that's thinking that our species is better than others. The reality is we share the world, one world, with these other 8 million species. And until we embrace the idea that they are part of our community, we will never treat the natural world with the respect that it deserves. Those are the two things I'd say. That's a great question.
Thank you, Barbara. And what a wonderful trip that must have been. You reminded me of a story. A friend of mine went to work in Canada. It was right before the pandemic, actually. And he really was struck by how friendly and outgoing and helpful Canadians were. So that's definitely still the case there, I think.
Yes, Casey. Thank you all so much.
All right. Thank you for calling. It's definitely the case right here in our community as well. 575-646-2212, the telephone number to call, be a part of our Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public. Kevin, you mentioned a mass extinction event underway right before our eyes. And you said that 1 million of the 8 million species on this planet are at risk of extinction?
Yes, biologists call this a biological annihilation. We are losing species of plants and animals and populations, which is even more important, I think, than the species for our well-being, at a very rapid rate due to human activities, over-harvesting, loss of, you know, destruction of habitat fragmentation, pollution, and climate change is a form of pollution. You know, since the first Earth Day was celebrated in 1970, vertebrate wildlife populations around the world have declined by an average of 2/3. That's just in my lifetime since the first Earth Day. So we really are facing a crisis of the fabric of life on the planet is unraveling, and it's happening everywhere. And there's been a lot of focus, and rightly so, on the climate change, the climate crisis. But the two are connected, and I think in my view they're equally a threat to not just human civilization, but to the survival of many species that we share the earth with, including our own.
Laura, I'd like to talk a little bit about your book, At the Precipice. What inspired you to write it?
So I've been covering climate change issues for a long time now, and I kind of wanted to put sort of all these various things that I've learned about New Mexico and the impacts of climate change in one place that would be that would help general readers kind of understand why climate change is happening and what the impacts are on our state. But I also hoped that it would provide a solid piece of a solid body of work for decision makers and for people who are in positions of authority and power within New Mexico. There's no denying climate change and why it's happening and what its impacts are. And for me, I just kind of wanted to put all of this stuff kind of in one place to help other people understand as well.
You know, we've already been told that this is going to be a pretty dismal year in terms of water for agriculure around the state. And what do you see as the ways to manage that going forward?
Yeah, we're going to have some serious conversations in New Mexico. We should have been having them far before now. You know, it's a touchy topic, but we need to talk about agriculture in New Mexico, looking at both surface water use and groundwater withdrawals. Agriculture in New Mexico accounts for about 80% of the water that's used. And so, you know, if we are going to use that much water for agriculture, we need to ensure that it's serving the needs of the people of New Mexico. You know, we kind of have this disconnect between how much water we use, how much farming we're doing, and say childhood food insecurity in the state. And so, you know, I would really like to see us moving toward just having some more realistic conversations. It's a painful conversation for lots of people, but we really need to figure out our agricultural water use. Of course, you know, we all use water. We can all be better about paying attention to where it comes from and how we use it and ensuring that our communities are as smart about water use as possible. But we kind of have these big structural issues in the state that it's not just about one person's water conservation. It's about a bigger statewide conversation, including about water planning. I don't think New Mexico has been very serious yet about water planning. Certainly, water planning hasn't been funded to the level that it should be in the state. And, you know, we're already in a water crisis in many areas, and so really need to pick up the pace on that one.
And no doubt, Kevin, that also has an impact on wildlife in our area.
Oh, yes, it does. It has for a long time, I will say. At the Southwest Environmental Center, we've been advocating for many years to restore the Rio Grande in southern New Mexico, because ever since Elephant Butte was completed in 1916, the dam there, the river has been turned on and off every year to meet the needs of farmers. But as a result, the river has dried up every year. And that's why we've lost many of our native fish species. And plus, we've lost a lot of the habitat along the river. And so that was pre-drought. You know, that was before climate change was really manifesting. And now we're seeing it. What happened, what we did in the south, in the lower Rio Grande, we're seeing that writ large in the other river systems in New Mexico. So, you know, we have an incredible diversity of wildlife in New Mexico, including our fish, our native fishes, and they've really taken it hard. I mean, they've been hit hard by the way we've changed our river systems, and now with the lack of water. So, yeah, it definitely has impacted wildlife.
Laura, you know, I would think maybe agriculture would naturally be
the thing that we use the most water for, other than, you know, our own home consumption. But what changes in agriculture are recommended moving forward?
So I think that we need to think about what kinds of crops we should be growing in the desert and at what scale. You know, there was a push a few years ago to get many farmers in the Mesilla Valley to move away from alfalfa and towards, say, pecans, which is a higher value crop, you know, kind of the idea that if we're going to be using all this water, should be a focus on a higher value crop. And it's still an incredibly water intensive crop. And then what happens is, you know, if you have an alfalfa field, you can fallow that field for a season, for a year, whatever, and still be able to come back to that crop in the future. If you don't have the water that you need for your pecans, your entire orchard will die. Or you'll invest in groundwater pumping, which is a problem in the Mesilla Valley. And I mean, in many places in New Mexico. But so I think we try to find solutions sometimes, but I think we need to really accept that we are an arid state that's becoming increasingly arid as it becomes increasingly warm. And so, you know, the kinds of crops that we're using, the scale at which we're growing particular crops, there's a lot of room for conversations and changes and positive changes that I believe could help communities, help farmers, help the river. You know, everything isn't this sort of black and white. If we do this, then it's going to be terrible. Making changes in our lives that are positive and healthy for the environment are also positive and healthy for communities, even if they're a little bit tricky when we're first talking about them.
When you said black and white, I started thinking about dairy cows. How about on the livestock side of our agriculture world?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because at New Mexico PBS, we've been doing a lot of coverage of military's contamination of groundwater in a couple of communities in New Mexico, including Clovis, which has a robust dairy industry. There's, I think, one of the largest cheese factories in the country is in the Portales area. And again, these are important industries to people and communities, but they're not sustainable in the long run if we're not confronting our water challenges in the state. We can't do everything, and we can't do everything that we've always done. We need to make changes, and I know that it's hard, but it's not going to be any easier if we punt the conversation another 10 years.
123 at KRWG. You're listening to the Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public. Thank you for joining us. 575-646-2212 if you have a question for PBS New Mexico environment reporter Laura Paskus and Southwest Environmental Center Executive Director Kevin Bixby. Kevin, I wanted to get back to the wildlife issues and in terms of something that we've been hearing a lot about for a few years, especially in our area, and that is how the border wall has affected wildlife or has the potential to. We just had a report this morning from Roz Brown of the Texas News Service about looking for a way to make a bigger habitat for native jaguars in the area. And you know, there was just a quick mention of how the border wall affected their habitat. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. We've been deeply engaged in this issue for the past 4 years, trying to stop the border wall for lots of reasons. Our focus has been primarily on the impact on wildlife. And what a lot of people may not realize is that wild animals need to move across the landscape to get what they need, to live their lives. They need to find water and they need to find food. They need to find mates for their kind to survive in the future. And the border wall as it was built in the last 4 years, has created this impenetrable barrier to any animal larger than a rabbit, say. And so, you know, you look out in the desert in southern New Mexico and you think, well, there's nothing out there. But the reality is this is a very important place for wildlife. New Mexico as a state ranks third in the number of mammal species within our boundaries. And a lot of that diversity of species is in the south, because the southern border of the United States is where the temperate region meets the tropics, and you have this mixing of faunas. And so we have a very high diversity of species, and the border wall has now created a barrier. There are still gaps. It was not completed under the Trump administration, but a lot of it was. And I'm hoping that the Biden administration will take it down in places where it is especially harmful to wildlife. Now, one of the species you mentioned is the jaguar. The jaguar used to live in the United States. You know, it was a Native American species, a U.S. species, from California to Louisiana, as far north as, you know, northern New Mexico. Now the closest resident population is in northern Mexico, about 100 miles south of the border. Those animals, individuals from that population occasionally come up to the United States, and they're seeking to, find new habitat, to recolonize their historic habitat. The border wall is going to make that much more difficult, because it was completed in areas that were historically travel corridors for jaguars. So it's a real issue. And it's also an issue for many other species, including the endangered Mexican wolves, which also occurred in the border area. And there's a population now in Mexico and one in the United States. They need to be able to mix in order to ensure the survival of the species. So, yeah.
Laura, I'm wondering, as you have done over the years you've been reporting on the environment in New Mexico, when have you come across some information that kind of made your jaw drop in terms of what was really shocking to you or surprising to hear along the way about the environment?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I can't stop thinking about, and Kevin was generous enough to bring our crew down to the border wall in the fall of 2019. And, you know, we were down there talking about various issues, including how the wall was going to affect wildlife crossings. But the kind of like the there's so much to say about the border wall in terms of environmental impacts, the amount of steel that went into that thing, the roads and the disruption and the construction and the impacts on wildlife and the impacts on our landscapes and on potentially on the aquifer in that area. It's just so extraordinary that as a species, we're so intent on whether your ideology is that you need to divide the two countries and keep people out, or it's an emphasis on the economy and the production of these materials and the issuance of these, you know, very lucrative contracts. But to slap this giant, giant wall in the middle of the desert, 30-foot steel bollards. I mean, if you've not stood next to this wall, it is extraordinary and overwhelming. And to just put that out there because of an ideology or profit, and the long-term implications of even trying to think about how to take down something like that, and just the extraordinary waste of materials and labor and everything else that goes into something like that. I would hesitate to call the border wall a metaphor, because it is very, very real. But I think in some ways it is a metaphor for how we tend to see our impacts on this planet. We don't think about all of these various implications that feed into this one thing and the very long-term impacts that we have with these crazy ideas. we come up with. And so I think for me, like really one of the most shocking things I've ever seen in my entire career is that wall along the border.
We have Rick on the line who actually wants to stay on this topic. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Voice of the Public. How are you?
Very good. I hike in the Potrillo Mountains, and I have worked as an archaeologist. I'm seeing the wall. Oh, I did 105 hikes there last year in the wall area, and or the bollard fence, I guess, is the, what you'd call it. First of all, that I'm not too upset about the wall. You know, the Great Wall in China wasn't to keep people out. It was to keep people on horseback out. And a lot of the wall was to to keep people from committing suicide by trying to make a trek from essentially from the border to Highway I-10. And it's been, I think it's worked in that way. Since the first of the year, the traffic of across has been, it's just been maybe three or four times what it was the year before. And I worry about that. The way you track someone coming in from Mexico is a much smaller foot size. And of course they're wearing tennis shoes or, you know, rubber soled shoes. It's a very dangerous thing for them to do. I see a need for a fence. Also, coyotes, deer, even a Mexican wolf that I saw, they have no trouble getting through. The only thing that really can't get through is even a jaguar can get through. Anyway, we've got a lot of things going on, but the drought in the desert area is so great. The only thing I see thriving, deer are doing pretty good, but the javelina population is up tremendously.
I know that, Rick, you're going to get a little bit of pushback here on whether or not those animals can fit through the fence, but I'm going to be actually the first to give you a little pushback, because here locally we have covered multiple stories of people falling to their deaths. So here are people who have already taken that terrible, you know, risky journey to get here and then try to scale that wall. And so it's really creating the opportunity for many more injuries. And you know, of course, what happens then is our Border Patrol agents and medical personnel, you know, we have to get them medical care and make sure that if we can, save their lives. So it definitely has created a new risk, I think, in terms of just physical well-being for those folks who of course, have chosen to make that journey for their own reasons, because they think it's a better option than what they've got at home. But you, Kevin, had a comment in terms of the gap on the bollards and the accessibility there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate Rick's comments, but I have to disagree with him about the animals and the ability to pass through that wall, because the gaps between the bollards are 4 inches. And if you're an animal with a skull that's wider than 4 inches, you're not going to be able to get through that fence. And that includes, you know, coyotes, bobcats, mountain lions, mule deer, javelina. We've seen them all out there. We set up a camera, about 15 wildlife cameras when the first 20 miles of the wall was being built, just to document the wildlife that was out there. And that's what we captured. And you know what? We had those 15 cameras out there for probably 10 months. We only got one image of a person crossing. A human crossing. We got a lot of animals, but there just wasn't a lot of crossing happening in that 20-mile stretch.
What animals were crossing?
Which animals?
Yeah.
All of those species were documented near the border line, so presumably they were all crossing. because that's what animals do.
You know, it's such a complex issue. And so, of course, part of that issue is immigration, Rick. But here on the Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public, and thank you for your call, you know, that's one of the things that we're going to have to confront is mass migration due to climate change. And that is one of the factors that is at play for people coming from Central America. Can either of you kind of speak to that issue at all in terms of what's happening, you know, climate-wise to drive people this direction?
Yeah, there's, you know, there's a lot of different factors, but know that there are farmers in Central America who are facing terrible drought conditions and, of course, warming conditions, having a harder and harder time being able to farm. So I think that's among the reasons why people are migrating. And, you know, I think that we can understand that people who face a journey as dangerous and uncertain as the migration to the United States is, and to face uncertain conditions within the United States, whether regardless of the presidential administration, and to know that, you know, that you could be apprehended, that you could be put into a camp, the need for a better life must be very great and very overwhelming. And I find it, you know, troubling that Americans are so quick to judge people who are undertaking such a devastating journey. Clearly, people need a lot of help.
575-646-2212 is the telephone number to be a part of this Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public here at KRWG Public Media. And in terms of worldwide, I mean we've talked for so long about whether, you know, the change in our climate is caused by man, or how much of it is caused by man, that it seems like maybe we've not seen the forest for the trees and really started thinking in terms of how to deal with the realities of the situation. Kevin, what would you say in terms of necessary policy changes to get us where we need to be?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a huge question. So we're facing these twin existential crises for the planet, for humans. One is climate change, and the other is the biodiversity crisis. And scientists tell us that we need to act within the next 10 years, because we've delayed action on both fronts for so long that we're quickly reaching a tipping point where we're not going to be able to get back to where we want to go or to protect what's left. And, you know, and on the matter of 10 years, 9 years is what we have left. I think that, and I'm sure Laura has some thoughts on this, but I think that the Biden announcement that yesterday or the day before, that his goal is to reduce global warming emissions by 50% by the end of the decade, I think that's tremendous. It's great that after 4 years of being an obstructionist, the United States is once again committing to dealing with the crisis of climate and taking a leadership role in the world. But frankly, 50% by 2030 is not enough, because we will still overshoot that will not keep the temperature increase below 1.5 degrees Celsius, which a lot of scientists say is what we need to do. So we need to do more. Right now, we're at a 1 degree increase since pre-industrial temperature era, and we're already seeing these huge effects of climate change, forest fires and mega drought and intense storms and rising sea levels and coral bleaching. So to go any more is going to be catastrophic. So we need those sorts of bold actions, and we need there's one proposal out there that would address both of these crises, and it's called 30 by 30, which means protecting 30% of the land area and the waters and the marine areas of the United States 30% by the year 2030. And that, in fact, is an interim goal for 50 by 50, 50% by 2050. These are things that if we can do these, if we can protect 30% by 2030 in conservation management, we can go a long ways towards preventing extinctions and also mitigating climate change, because natural areas are some of the best and most cost-efficient ways to address climate change, to sequester carbon. And so we have to maintain these areas where they're intact. We need to restore them where we've lost them. So this is a very important, I think. It's another one of these bold policy moves. President Biden has endorsed it. You know, it's going to be very difficult to implement. A lot of questions in how it would be implemented. But I think that's those are the kinds of things we need to be doing, because we are in a moment where we have no time left. We've run out of time. It's the bottom of the ninth inning. If we don't get a hit, we lose the game.
Oh, well. Laura, before we get your thoughts on some policy changes, we need to take a call. Beverly has been holding to talk about the drought. Hi, Beverly. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about the severity of the drought. In my own yard or in my own area, we've had no rain, just simply slight traces. We had maybe a 2-inch snow, but it was very, very light and fluffy. And so, you know, most of it evaporated. I have lots of trees. I have 16 cypress trees. I have pine trees. I have ash. In other words, my property is surrounded by trees, and I'm having to water them every week. And so it's quite a problem. I'm trying to figure out what to do. I'm thinking in terms of maybe pruning some of the branches and reducing the need for water in the tree. Anyway, so that's my specific problem, and I'm trying hard to solve it. But we've got trees all over Las Cruces.
Well, sure. And we're supposed to have trees, right? Because they are what helps. But then we don't want the ones that we have to water too much. But sorry for stepping on you. Go ahead.
Oh, that's fine. That's what people do, you know, in conversation.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, I know that Mayor Mugiashima has talked about how are we going to keep our trees in Las Cruces. So it's a matter of being convinced that you really need to water. There are some people that just simply hold the hose by the trunk and let a little water run. And, you know, that's not going to do it. It's going to be what's going to happen, of course, is trees will start dying.
Yeah, Kevin has a suggestion here, and so does Laura. Both hands went up. Laura first. Okay, go ahead.
Oops, sorry. So just a couple of things that I wanted to mention. Protecting our trees, especially trees that can survive in our environment, are super important. And I know here in Albuquerque, the Water Utility Authority has really tried to emphasize to people, water your trees, protect your trees. You know, my personal opinion, let your grass die. Don't have ornamental plants you don't necessarily need. Go for those natives that are good for pollinators. But really, treating your trees in smart and thoughtful and careful ways is really important. And there are lots of guides out there that can help you be planting the right kind of tree for your environment, but also how to take care of your tree in the best way. For example, I bought a house a few years ago, and I'd never really had to take care of my trees, and I wasn't watering them the right way. They should be watered sort of where your crown of the tree is. If you draw a little line to the ground, you should be watering out in that area, not like at the trunk. And I just want to mention that for people, not just in Las Cruces, but all over the state, The NMSU Cooperative Extension Service is amazing. If you look up their website and find their contacts, I've gotten in touch with Marisa Thompson before. She is awesome and will help you with advice on keeping your trees alive. There's tons and tons of resources online at extension.nmsu.edu.
Thank you for that. And Kevin, what did you have to add?
Yeah, I mean, Laura's absolutely right. We need trees. Trees help keep our cities cool. And that's going to be very important as the climate continues to heat up. You know, there was an interesting monitoring program that happened in Las Cruces last year where people went out and drove around these routes in the city and measured the temperature at ground level. And some of the places that were measured were like incredibly hot during the afternoon, like 120, 130 degrees. I don't exactly know what the max was, but I remember seeing, wow, that's incredible. People are actually living there, and this is how hot it is. And of course, when it's that hot where you live, you're going to turn on your air conditioner if you have an air conditioner, and that's going to use a lot of electricity and produce more carbon emissions. So trees are really important. Plus, they take up a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. There are ways to be smart with water. It's called rainwater harvesting. And on a bigger scale, green infrastructure, where you can, even though it doesn't rain very often, you can plant and create, you know, topography where you plant to capture the rain when it rains. And cities like Tucson have done a great job like this. And I think Albuquerque has too. Laura can tell us that. But where they do things like, instead of having, when it rains, having all the water run down the street and into a stormwater sewer system, there are cuts on the curbs periodically where the water can be diverted into swales, these depressions, where you can plant trees. So when it does rain, you can water your trees. And that's a great way to keep your trees alive and make good use of the water.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, Beverly. And Leo is on the line with a question about water. And I'm assuming, Leo, the border fence?
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, I just want to know if anyone knows, I've been trying to find this out, how many gallons of water were wasted on that fence for the concrete? And, you know, when I would run by there, because I jog along the fence sometimes, they'd be spraying water so they didn't get any dust. I'm just wondering if there's any estimate as far as the amount of water that was used to build that fence.
I don't know, but that is a great, great question.
Yeah. Kevin, any idea?
Yeah. So I don't have the number, but it was a huge amount. And I'm not sure where the water came for the fence in New Mexico. I assume that was groundwater trucked in from somewhere. But in Arizona, where they were building the fence, they were building it through some really important protected natural areas. Where there were some springs, some natural springs. And the contractors there drilled wells and pumped out shallow groundwater for the concrete, and those springs began to dry up. So we definitely know there's an impact on groundwater for border wall construction. Mm.
Thanks, Leo, for the call. What about water and fracking? And the future of fracking in New Mexico. I'm looking at both Laura and Kevin. They both have their mics muted. Apparently, neither one of you. No, oh, Laura's going to take it. All right.
So the oil and gas industry is a water-intensive industry in the United States, but here in New Mexico. And you know, one of the things that we see, particularly in the southeastern part of the state, is people who can't make a living anymore ranching or farming, leasing or selling their water rights to the oil and gas industry. And so, you know, one of the issues with the water that's used in the oil and gas industry is that water is polluted. It's not just, it's not like ag water that sinks into the ground. I mean, ag water can have contamination from fertilizers and pesticides as well, but it's, you know, it doesn't sink back into the water table and potentially, you know, restore sort of green spaces. You know, it is a very polluted byproduct. So certainly that's something to think about in addition to reducing our methane emissions and greenhouse gas emissions, to be thinking about how we reduce the use of fresh water in the industry.
Well, Laura, let's take this opportunity to get back to the topic of policy changes. And maybe you can address some of the ones that have been made this last legislative session, in fact, in New Mexico.
Yeah, so the two state agencies kind of working in cooperation with one another, New Mexico Environment Department and the Oil Conservation Division, are developing separately but related rules that are centered around the reduction of methane emissions and greenhouse gases from the oil and gas industry. And so that's, you know, those rules are still being worked out, and lots of people have lots of opinions on them, but they are a step forward for the state to be tackling this issue and taking the issue of climate change seriously. So we kind of need to be working on a couple of different fronts when it comes to policies for climate change. We need to be talking about the front end of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, stopping the release of so much methane, carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere that's causing warming. But we also need to be taking seriously sort of adaptation efforts, whether that's water planning or thinking about what kinds of houses we build and don't build, our energy use, things like that. And that's something, the adaptation side of things can be happening on the federal and the state level, and certainly with federal funding, but it's something that local communities can be thinking about. I know the city of Las Cruces and their sustainability office, I think it's called, are talking about lots of these issues. And so whatever the kind of adaptation that your community needs to be thinking about into the future, you can be tackling those issues starting now. You know, for the sort of borderlands area of New Mexico, I often think about, it's already hot there. Like Kevin was just talking about, you know, sort of grabbing those temperatures. It's already very warm. When you think about more temperature increase over the next few years and into the future, you know, what kinds of, are we living in cinder block houses that have swamp coolers? That's pretty much not going to be inhabitable. Mm-hmm. But we also don't want to be, you know, firing up our air conditioning. So these are solutions that we can be looking toward right now.
Well, I'm sure it's a dumb idea, but it just seemed so logical to me to keep the Keystone Pipeline, but just bring water to the desert through it. That way, if it leaks, you know, there's no huge environmental impact. But Kevin, I wanted to touch a little bit on some more legislation that was enacted during this legislative session that favors wildlife. What did you take away from that session?
Oh, well, there were some very good bills for wildlife that did not pass. One was a bill that Jeff Steinborn and Nathan Small introduced that would have changed the mission of our wildlife agency, the Department of Fish and Game, Game and Fish, to protect biodiversity, essentially, to go from being a hunter-focused organization to one that was really focused on, you know, addressing the biodiversity crisis in New Mexico, and would have given the agency the authority to do that. Unfortunately, that did not pass. Nor did the Green Amendment, which would have put a constitutional amendment on the ballot that guaranteed the rights of New Mexicans to a functioning, healthy environment. And that would have been key, because it would have been in the Bill of Rights section, and people could have sued agencies if they violated that. That didn't pass either. These will come back in future years. But one that did pass, and which was very important, was Roxie's Law, which banned the use of traps, snares, and poisons on public lands in New Mexico. And you know, it's these things don't have a huge impact on populations of animals as much as they do on individual animals. And again, it goes back to the idea that a lot of our problems that we're dealing with now are the legacy of thinking that humans are somehow better than the rest of the nature, better than the rest of the species on the planet, and we can do whatever we want to nature. And Roxy's Law was a step in the other direction of respecting wild animals.
155 already. I can't believe it. 575-646-2212. If we can sneak you in, we will. But thank you so much for being with us on Voice of the Public. It's our Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public here on KRWG Public Media. There was something I wanted to touch on. It was so many months ago, but pandemic has made it hard to recall exactly when this story occurred. But there were thousands or maybe even hundreds of thousands of birds that kind of just fell out of the sky. Laura, what can you say about what happened to those animals?
Yeah, that was devastating for New Mexicans to experience and see. My understanding of the analysis that was done is many of these birds were emaciated and in poor condition when they began their migration, which means they didn't have the food sources. They didn't have the food that they needed when they started migration, which is, takes an enormous toll on your little body flying, you know, thousands of miles. And then there were a number of other factors, a storm, wildfires in the West. It was a combination of really unfortunate factors. And what's even more upsetting for me to think about in terms of what happened last fall is, as we see accelerated climate change, as we see accelerated habitat loss, these sorts of things could become more and more common. So really that diversity that Kevin's been talking about is so important, whether it's the diversity of our birds or diversity of the food sources that are available to birds when and where they need it. So important.
Kevin, what should people be doing who are listening, saying, well, what am I supposed to do about it?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, there's lots of things we can do as individuals just in our own lifestyle. We can eat less meat, for example, that has less of an environmental impact. We can, use our car less. We can use less plastic, you know, take our bags to the grocery store. But there's only so much that individuals can do. A lot of these are big problems that need also governmental action. And so we need to support policies that are going to address the problem in a significant way. And so one of the most important things people can do is to vote and to vote for people, individuals, officials that support these types of policies to address, you know, first of all, that believe these problems exist, and then who are willing to take bold action to address them. That's what people can do.
Laura, what would you suggest?
Same. Your vote matters. And also, after you voted, make sure you keep being in touch with those elected officials to let them know these issues are important to you, because industry is meeting and spending money and doing everything they can to ensure that their perspective is heard. So keep at it. We're so lucky in New Mexico to have such accessible legislators. Call them up, write them a letter when things change a little bit, request a meeting, go up to the roundhouse, pay attention to the committee meetings that are happening even throughout the year. You can make a difference here in New Mexico.
I'm excited about, the ability to see things change, because we might be at that point where it's just too costly not to take action. So in the next few years, we'll be seeing some things change, like infrastructure for electric vehicles. Is that the direction that we need to be going?
Yes, we definitely need to see our infrastructure change, whether that's to ensure that you can charge your electric vehicle with something other than coal-fired electricity from a coal-fired power plant, but all kinds of infrastructure changes, from our public transportation to our water to our grids. Lots of work to do.
Lots of work to do, that's for sure. Go ahead, Kevin. What would you like to add?
I forgot to mention that here's an astonishing statistic. 1/3 of the food grown in the world never gets eaten. It's a huge source of greenhouse gases, wasted food. So, you know, that's another thing that people can do here in the United States is not waste food. You know, if you buy, you know, buy only what you're going to eat. If you go to the, you know, serve yourself buffet, you know, be modest. You know, there's lots of, that's just one thing, but it could have a big impact.
Oh, I can't wait to go to another buffet. Kevin Bixby, Executive Director of the Southwest Environmental Center, thank you so much for spending some time with us this afternoon. You'll have to come back for part two.
Thank you. I'd be glad to.
And Laura Paskus, great to have you on today. Thank you so much. And where can we find your book?
Thank you, Casey. You can find it at the University of New Mexico Press website or any of your local independent bookstores.
All right. And thank you for joining us today for our Earth Day edition of Voice of the Public. So glad to have you along. And if you're just tuning in, you can find it just a little bit later at krwg.org. Coming up next after NPR News, stay tuned for Intermezzo by Request with Leora Zeitlin. On the way next on KRWG Public Media.